From Japan, that shows real dedication. Good evening, Greg.
Hey, Allison. Thanks. Yeah, sorry I couldn't be here, but at least I got it virtually.
All right, very good. All right, Dan, over.
Oh, Allison, I do have a couple more announcements. Sorry, Dan.
Oh, no problem.
Then you can go. We do have an event in October, and it will be a friend of mine from Tesla who did his PhD work at MIT around autonomous vehicle planning and decision making. His name is Sterling Anderson. So you'll be in October, probably the third week in October. I'll make sure it doesn't conflict with our other activity, Allison. And then November is still pending. So that's my only announcement.
And let's congratulate Greg, who is a new father. All right, now it's time to get started.
Okay. That sounded like this. Can everyone hear in the back? Okay, as Allison mentioned, it's not going to work. As Allison mentioned, I'm Dan Bartz. I've been working in this automated vehicle space for about 15 years. I also worked at both GM and Ford in the past, so I've got a lot of automotive background. And I'm going to talk a little bit about a topic that very early in my career kind of excited me because of some of the people I work with. And so this is kind of telling a bit of their story and a little bit of how I see the world. And I'd love to have any people's thoughts one way or the other as to what they think. But so I guess here we go. Interesting quote from PBS documentary, I think. I guess the clicker's not clicking, so let's do it this way. Okay. So everyone knows that the first automated vehicles were invented in 2005 for the DARPA Grand Challenge, and that automated vehicles are only going to happen absolutely within 5 years. There's no possibility that won't happen. And car ownership will be over, and the automobile has been able to take advantage of all this technology that came from cell phones that didn't exist before then, right? Well, I've got a little bit different view on some of those, so I'm going to share a little bit about the history as I've been able to dig it up. So, by the way, I took that shot. I was there during that competition. So, let's see. Okay, so first some inspirational quotes. Okay, you need to get a laugh in there somewhere. So, this is a friend of mine who mentored me when I was a co-op student at GM Research, by a guy named Bill Spreitzer. And I started at GM, and he was this guy who was just kind of around once a week. And no one really spent a lot of time talking to him, so I did as a co-op student, had lots of free time. And he told me about this history of automated vehicles and the stuff that he did back in the 1950s, and why it's such a shame that this technology hasn't gone anywhere, and about working on jet engines for passenger cars, and all this really exciting stuff. Gave me a lot of video, a lot of material I have here today, and really got me, inspired me to go into automated driving before it was even really cool. And Bill is in here, the Firebird 2, which is a car that he worked on. It was the second turbine-powered car that GM had developed, in a car that would be used in the 1956 Motorama video, where GM first publicly described how their automated system was going to work. So as we go back in time and see Bill Spreitzer back in his younger years, we're going to go back in time for this talk as well. So. Now, I like history a lot, so I'm going to talk a little bit about the history before we get into automation, just to kind of set some themes. So, like the Grand Challenge made automated driving such a publicly visible thing, the first time people were aware of these horseless carriages was a race in 1895. The race had over 100 original entries. Only 6 vehicles got to the starting line. It was 56 miles through Chicago, or excuse me, 54 miles through Chicago. And after 10 hours and many stops for repairs, Frank Duryea crossed the finish line. So 10 hours to do 54 miles. And one other vehicle, Benz, would follow him. All the other vehicles broke down irreparably during the race. Now, what's the point of a race like this? It was to show that these vehicles were reliable. And they weren't reliable, and that by having races, in showing that your vehicle can get to the finish line with as fewer repairs as possible, it was actually a publicity stunt to try to promote the automobile. And it actually worked quite well because car racing became a very popular spectator sport. I'll talk about this later. By the way, a lot of technology was developed during racing. And I've got a whole list of them on my next slide. But this one, by the way, is the 1902 Porsche gas electric hybrid. Porsche wanted a car as fast as an electric car with the range of a gasoline car. And so he developed this car. Unfortunately, he didn't get to race because he had health problems and kind of missed some of the opportunities to race this car. But those are wheel motors in the front wheels. This is 1902. The Ford Sweepstakes was the first car to use ceramic spark plugs. It was also the car that made Ford famous when he was able to beat a much faster car because his car was more reliable, didn't break down, and was able to win the Grosse Pointe race. And this was the race he was able to get the venture capital to start the Ford Motor Company. And so, a lot of people know the history from there. But by the time we get to 1910s, the Ford Model T is now, in the process of selling, the total 20 million vehicles that would sell. It revolutionized the automobile. High reliability, low cost, at the lowest point, $400. And how do you compete with something like that? A few years later, General Motors decided that they were going to take on Ford, not by undercutting them on price, but beating them on innovation, both in the technology, in the styling, and in the business model. And some of the things that GM brought to bear was the first use of dealer trade-ins, where you could trade in your old car and get money on your new one, the first on-the-spot financing at the dealership, so it looked like you were paying less for your car than you really were. And the annual model change gave you a reason to buy a new car this year, even though you bought one last year, because you have a year-old car, and who wants to be seen in a year-old car? The first industrial research labs, pretty much in almost any industry, had been developed to help spur this continuous innovation, because you have a new car every year, it's got to have new technology, it's really exciting. And the styling guys really want technology to help them out. For example, this is one of the first cars to be available in, mass-produced cars to be available in color, because a fast-drying color paint had to be invented that could allow cars to be mass-produced and still be painted. Ford picked black because black dried fast, and that's why you had everything color you want as long as it's black. Okay, so throughout the years, you see the car evolve, and you come up with new things, like concept cars. Cars showing off technology that isn't quite ready, but you'll see in a few years. So this is the Buick Y-Job, and really sets the tone for what the post-war cars are going to look like. If you look at, from 25 to 37, it's a pretty big jump, both stylistically and technologically.
When the car leaves the factory, can everyone hear this? Only one thing is needed for safety, and that's careful driver. If the manufacturer could equip every car with an automatic driving mechanism, the car would always do just what it should do when it got out on the road. With such a driving control, the car wouldn't pull away from the curb without signaling or looking back for oncoming traffic. With such a driving control, the car would keep in line instead of weaving in and out of traffic. With such control, it would always get into the proper lane before turning. It would always obey boulevard stop signs. With an automatic driving mechanism, the car would stop before cutting into traffic. It wouldn't pass other cars on dangerous curves. And it would always come to a stop before crossing a railroad. Whether or not your car is the safest place depends entirely on you, the driver of the car.
Okay, so that was a video produced during the 1930s. This is 1935. It was part of a series of videos. Many of them were trying to explain technology to the average layperson. How does a transmission work? How does an engine work? A number of different books, if anyone wants to look through these later, were published. This one, A Primer on Power, explains how do spark plugs work, how do pistons work, how do crankshaft works, because in the 1920s, 1930s, as people were being introduced to cars, not everyone was comfortable with change. In fact, most people weren't. And so a big part of what the auto industry had to do was get people accustomed to rapid change, get them comfortable with new technology only a few years after, you know, it was first available. You know, automatic transmission, I think, was invented in the 36, or at least in the 30s, and that was a really controversial technology, but they did a fantastic job of explaining to people why, you know, they should buy an automatic transmission. Just a step back on for people who are, you know, from the automated control video, autopilot had been introduced in airplanes just a few years earlier. Automatic landing systems were being developed, and so ideas of going to automation for cars wasn't that inconceivable for the engineers in the 1930s. And so part of a video like that was to kind of get customers thinking about it, starting to gauge the reaction to, you know, what the world could be. By the time we get to the late 1930s, we've got the World's Fair coming up. General Motors wants something that will blow people away, and so they hire a futurist by the name of Norman Bell Geddes to do the Futurama exhibit, of which I think the second one was actually at Disney World for quite a while. And this is a snippet from the video. Many of you in this industry may have seen, but I want to give a little bit more background to it.
We see an enlarged section of 1960s express motorway. Along the ledge of this beautiful precipice, traffic moves at unreduced rates of speed. Safe distance between cars is maintained by automatic radio control. Curved sides assist the driver in keeping his car within the proper lane under all circumstances. The keynote of this motorway, safety. Safety with increased speed.
One of the things that's not immediately apparent by this video, but if you read his book, is the three sets of lanes are different speeds for different purposes. The 100-mile-per-hour lane is the one, the innermost one, and that is for usually for high-speed transport or for just getting things coast-to-coast efficiently. And the goal was to be able to get products from New York to San Francisco in 24 hours. And if you had the right highway design and you can maintain 100 miles per hour, it was theoretically possible to do that in 24 hours. If you had automation, there's a 75 lane, which is a little bit more mixed, and then the 50 mile per hour lane was for the scenic routes that took a lot more meandering, travels places and places people would want to see, not just, you know, the most efficient way to get from point A to point B. Oops. The Autorama exhibit, Futurama exhibit, had these big dioramas showing what, you know, highways of the future would look like, cities of the future. It was interesting here how he would separate sidewalks. If you can see in the bottom corner, sidewalks are elevated above the roadway so that you never have to cross the roadway at grade. This is very similar to how a lot of the bullet trains work in Japan. There are no at-grade crossings. And so safety between cars and humans colliding wasn't really an issue, at least in the city context in the visionary world of Bell Geddes. One of the things he realized, and I think this is a really important idea to understand, is that if you automate, you don't necessarily get a whole lot of benefit if you only automate, or if you can only get higher throughput on the straightaway sections of the highway. That it's really about identifying and addressing bottlenecks that was the key to improving the flow. Because highways flow pretty nicely if, you know, everything is going well, but when you have off-ramps and on-ramps, when you have merging, that's where the bottlenecks happen and that's where most of the traffic happens. So what he did is he took the 75-foot turning radius of a conventional cloverleaf and made it into a 1,000-foot turning radius so that you could maintain 100 miles per hour going on the on-ramps and off-ramps, you know, in his vision of the world. He also would say the highway should never go really close to the cities because then you're going to get the traffic issue. You have to have proper feeder routes to bring all the traffic together. It's a nice quote from him. Human nature unaided does not make for efficient driving. New York Times, 1940. So this was one of his concepts for both doing the lighting of the roads and the automatic guidance. It was a buried cable that the automated car would follow. But in these cars of 1960s and the highways in which they drive, remember he's writing this in 1940, will have in them devices which would correct the faults of human beings as drivers. They would prevent the driver from committing errors. They will prevent his turning out in traffic except when he should. They would aid him in passing through intersections without slowing down or causing anyone else to do so or endangering himself or others. There's not necessarily talking about eliminating human driving, just eliminating the bad parts of human driving with driving aids and allowing for automation. So then he also talks about further development of this system along the lines of car-to-car radio hookup might be used to advise a driver nearing the intersection of the approach of another car or even maintain control and speed of spacings in the same traffic lane. So, you know, he's talking here about, you know, a lot of the platooning type ideas with car-to-car radio. He also talks about, and it's kind of hard for you to see, but this is an unsignalized intersection where cars are coordinate over radio and they go through the intersection without stopping. And, you know, this concept has been talked about recently, but this was 1940 that he was talking about this, and he was explaining all the dynamics of how that would work using car-to-car radio.
The General Motors Parade Department,
so,
traveling the high roads and by roads of America.
Back to trying to get customers excited
America
about technology.
Your own hometowns, fascinating story behind modern industry, showing actual performances of many of the amazing processes of research that lead to a new and better mode of living for all of us. The Parade of Progress was suggested by Charles Franklin Kettering, research chief for General Motors. Mr. Kettering believes that if some of the basic principles and achievements of research and science were popularized and brought to us in a more understandable form, we could get a better conception of the secret of America's industrial leadership and the promise it holds for the future.
So for those who didn't pick up all of that, what the video is talking about is that in addition to just, you know, selling cars, you know, Charles Kettering at General Motors and a number of other leading visionaries thought you had to sell science and technology to a customer who had, you know, been dealing with plows and horses for most of his life. And so there was a pretty big effort at outreach in terms of the basics of science. And here is a book written by Dr. Kettering, Short Stories of Science and Innovation. There was also a radio show on, I forget if it was weekly or monthly, but where it's not about cars, it's about the history of inventions over time and why progress is important. And let's see. Oops, that's not the right one. Hold on. Where are we at? Hit end. Sorry, give me 1 second. Apologize. Okay. I think we're, oops. Yeah, okay, so we're here. World War II happens here. So, 1939 is right before, you know, World War II. The world is now involved in war, and it's devastating. It's I mean, it's a really horrible thing. You know, tens of millions of people die. But the world has changed after war. You know, they started the war with biplanes and ended with jet planes, and ballistic missiles, you know, would wreak terror, you know, that we'd never have before. And the invention of the computer also helped lead to the invention of atomic power and the ability to harness it. And the world after World War II was a completely changed place. And these technologies would actually drive the next generation of automotive research. You could see directly comes from World War II. This is the Firebird 2 I'd mentioned earlier. There was a Firebird 1, which was also a jet-powered car, but using an actual airplane engine. This is the first automotive turbine engine designed specifically for fuel economy and roadability. It's a four-passenger car, and if you read the SAE paper on it, it's fantastic. Body is made out of titanium, and it's one of the first cars in the world to have disc brakes and really, really innovative automobile. One of the first active suspension systems. It was also a PR piece for the 56 Futurama exhibit. Oh, Motorama exhibit.
We're heading to Chicago. Please route us through. Over.
Roger, MP2.
View screen map shows your location within our control zone.
You have your choice of two routes.
Green line marks city.
His, we bump the volume.
Headline shorter route.
We're on vacation. Who wants to fly?
Yeah, that means green. I'll tell the guy.
I'm up. That's why he's in
volume. Tower. We'll take the green.
Roger, move to electronic control strip in center lane.
So some of you may have seen this video. There's an interesting part that gets usually edited out, but...
Well done, Firebird 2. You're now under automatic control. Hands off steering.
Here we go on the high-speed safety lane.
This has been drastically edited down. It was much longer, but I tried to keep the good parts. So.
Sir, East North Interchange. The safe, easy way to make a turn.
What would be the 50s without a sing-along?
We gotta slow down, slow down. Mr. Sun is just about to go down. Hey, Mr. Towerman, where do we light? Where do you suggest that we relax for the night?
Okay, fire. Is a honey and the hostess is a dream.
Although this is a video phone, this is like FaceTime in their car.
Good evening, modern travelers. Won't you be our guest? We have pushed button living at its very best. There's automatic sleep control in every bed, and our pre-digested food is cooked by infrared.
Anyway, if you want to see the rest of it, it's on YouTube. I just thought most people hadn't seen the musical portion, and so it's actually pretty interesting because there's a concierge service, there's video phone in the car. You know, it's a visionary piece. It wasn't practical at the time, but it showed what they were thinking, and. The underlying technology that the video is really focusing on, the automated electric highway, had actually been developed several years earlier by RCA, 1953, by the same gentleman, I'm forgetting the name, but the same guy who developed the picture tube for television. And RCA eventually worked with General Motors. And by the way, this is a General Motors project called Unicontrol. It's the first drive-by-wire system. Airplanes didn't have fly-by-wire at this point. It would be several years later on another General Motors collaboration that you would have fly-by-wire systems. But the first drive-by-wire system was developed in the mid-50s. And you see there's a buried wire under the road that's telling the vehicle where to go. Now, General Motors is doing a lot of this automatic guidance. During the same time, a lot of the other automakers are working in other aspects of either automated driving or active safety technology. Namely, Chrysler was working on collision mitigation braking and adaptive cruise control using radar. Bendix was also developing their own automotive radar. Radar had been developed, small radars had been developed earlier in the 40s for police radar guns. And there was even a New York Times article that had the scoop that radar was going to be introduced in the 1947 model Cadillac, which it didn't actually happen. So the technology is actually happening quite a bit. And Ford's working on car-to-car communication, car-to-infrastructure communication. So these ideas have been around for quite a while, just using different technologies. A lot more vacuum tubes back then. And speaking of vacuum tubes, there's some of them. This was a partially vacuum tube vehicle. Most of the actual guidance was done with transistors, but vacuum tubes had much better control characteristics, and they're also faster. And so you know, you had this mix of computing technologies. And keep in mind, General Motors at this point, like many of the automakers, was one of the most preeminent research labs in the world. General Motors had developed the first computer operating system. They developed the first computer graphics system in the 50s. And so they were kind of a really leading edge computer developer as much as they were an automaker. If you think about the parallels today with the computer companies are trying to get into automation, it wasn't that unheard of that cars and computers go together. And there's a lot of interesting papers on stability control from the 50s and electronic stability control and how you do it. This car actually had an electronic stability control system. I can talk about later. Here's the car being pulled together. This is another Firebird. This is another turbine engine, more advanced turbine engine. Very drastically different shape of car. You can see that the center console has the joystick that they had talked about earlier. And there's the buried wire pickup. Also, there's one main headlamp that's fluorescent. They're trying to get efficient back then with highly efficient fluorescent lighting. Never took off in car headlamps, but it's a really cool thing to see in video. And then here's a little snippet about the highlights. I cut this down from a really long video, so.
Many original engineering features have been incorporated into this chassis. The frame, for example, with its rigid spine and wishbone construction to accommodate the passenger and engine arrangement. And the unique front axle and steering mechanism made possible by this fully powered control. Unicontrol is a new concept in steering, designed to simplify your driving task. This system uses specially developed electronic computers to control hydraulic power servos, which actuate the brakes, throttle, and steering. Push forward to accelerate, steer left or right. Pull back for braking. Rotation of the control knob selects forward, reverse, or park. There is no mechanical connection between the control knob and the front wheels, but car motion feedback is supplied to the driver by the mass of the knob. To this, we have also added AutoGuide, an automatic guidance system, and cruise control. Two pickup coils mounted under the front of the car straddle a cart carrying wire embedded in the highway. Coils receive signals that are fed to the steering system computer in the electronic control and electric power center. The electrical signals are converted into hydraulic power at this servo valve manifold to guide the car along its course.
I hope you guys are finding this as fascinating as I am.
This brake mechanism and a new anti-skid device gives unsurpassed driving security.
The anti-skid is the stability control.
To give Firebird 3 a smoother ride and better roadability, the research laboratories have designed a high-pressure air-oil suspension system in which the front and rear springs are interconnected to suppress pitching motions of the car. These springs are connected to the large axle tube here.
Independent suspension.
The wheels are driven by short shafts from the chassis-mounted powertrain. This is the Whirlfire GT305, the most compact, efficient gas turbine automobile engine today.
So, get ready for a ride in Firebird 3. You are here. Squeeze your sonic key, and sound waves open the door.
I love that interior, you know?
The sonic key is also used to start the car. First, the small accessory engine. Then, the gas turbine. Brake flaps provide additional braking. You're ready now.
You're gonna need it.
For the driving thrill of a lifetime.
And if you hear these things, they actually sound like airplanes in real life.
sit back and relax? Well then, set in the speed you want to drive and switch over to automatic guidance. Release the stick, and Firebird 3 is on its own, receiving its commands from a wire in the road. This certainly is the future. Your future. Brought to motors need.
So, What you don't hear in this video, because it was invented later, is the wire that tells the car where to go also will eventually communicate all of the actual driving controls. So what speed to go no longer has to be set with a little knob thing. It will be told by the highway itself. And when there are obstacles in the road ahead, the highway would have the sensors to detect them and to tell the car to stop. Even though computing was very limited at the time, the idea was making the computing offboard and having the highway do most of the heavy lifting would be one way to get ahead of the, you know, we don't have the fast enough computers. And it's very similar to the Sage missile system. If you go to the Computer History Museum and look how we had all these distributed missile commands that were trying to detect Soviet missiles and shoot them down, it was the same idea that was being developed here, was that you'd have centralized control of all the cars on the automatic highway. And Jim actually went to Congress, had pitched this idea in the late 50s. They'd actually gotten, by the 60s, interest in a number of the different states to pay for large sections of automated highway. Michigan, Ohio, and Massachusetts together would do 100 miles at a cost of $3 million. So that's $30,000 per mile to do this. And at the time, there was nothing that people saw that would prevent this technology from happening, at least nothing technical that people saw. You'd also see by the 59, this is Cadillac's radar system on the Cyclone. I said other car companies had radar, but this was kind of the coolest looking one. So this car is also interesting, is that it had two transmissions, a three-speed engine transmission, and then a two-speed transaxle, which is a new concept to give it six speeds. And it was just a really interesting automobile. You can see here the center instrument cluster at the very top tells you the proximity of the car in front of you and your stopping distance. And if those ever crossed, then there would be a warning that went off. And like I said, the press was really picking up. So this is Popular Science, I think, 58. You'd see automatic roads offer good speed with safety, automatic control system eliminates driver, a group will study electronic roads. This is just New York Times and one other magazine I was looking at, because there's not a lot. It's very hard to find this stuff electronically. And going to libraries, most libraries don't hold materials going way back. I actually had to go up to Berkeley to find a lot of the hard print material, because nobody keeps these magazines and newspapers from the 50s. But you would see things like Pageant magazine, which covered beauty pageants, would talk about automated driving. So the press was out there. But let's see if I have it here. But what you did start to see was the automakers are having a hard time selling safety as a concept. Ford in 57 would have their lifeguard systems, safety systems, and they told how unsafe cars were, and that they should buy these new Fords with seat belts and padded dashes, and they saw their sales decline very precipitously, because that wasn't a very good message, or it wasn't a very popular message. Whether it was the right message or not, it didn't sell well. And Motor Trend did a study in 58 and asked car drivers, what they thought about accidents and their likelihood to get an accident, how good of drivers they were. And 90% of people thought that they were excellent drivers, and that everyone else was the problem. Motor Trend made a comment that it's going to be hard for automakers. It's an uphill battle for automakers to sell safety, given that everyone thinks that safety is someone else's problem. And so, they hadn't really gotten the convenience message. They hadn't gotten some of the other aspects as a sales pitch. They hadn't done the work they had done before the war in terms of convincing people, explaining to people the technology, how it worked. People were against technology they didn't like, or were afraid of technology they didn't like. They didn't trust it. So this is from Business Week 1958. Many drivers are unwilling to turn over full control to a black box. And laws would have to be passed to make this legal system anyway. And it talks about how people didn't trust the automated systems. Even if the engineers had the best data, it's getting people familiar with them breeds comfort. And that was one area where these automakers are so far ahead of their time that they had kind of lost that, in my opinion, kind of lost that touch. But anyway, by 1964, General Motors had decided to use its resources elsewhere. And it started working. The engineers working on the auto guide system were moved. A lot of them moved to Santa Barbara, California, to work on the Apollo program. GM designed the navigation computer for Apollo. They designed the guidance system for the Apollo missions. They also designed the lunar rover. And so this is the center console of the lunar rover. And notice any similarities? So there are three vehicles in the solar system that are, very useful vehicles that had this control system, but it didn't go, much beyond that, at least for quite a while. And there's some other cultural things going on that was a bit hard for the automakers to get the message across. By the way, sidestep, one technology that did sort of get there, was the William Alden developed what he called the Self Transport Systems Corporation, the Star Car. It was a connected, autonomous, shared electric pod car that he was promoting. The design would evolve to a more conventional PRT system, but still wheels on pavement with a buried wire guidance. And by 1970, it would be put into place in Morgantown, West Virginia, for the university there, and still in use today. It was championed by both President Nixon and Senator Byrd. And it was interesting, unique that you could request that the shuttle pick you up, you can give it a schedule. It was something that was more than just a tram. And it only costs 8 times the original projected budget. So it's not what it ended up looking like, but the idea was pretty much the same. So what happened? So these are just some of my observations, and whether or not you agree, this is what's been going on, what was going on in the era. So first of all, what we saw was in the 1950s, some of the automakers were afraid that the car sales among youth were going down. And at first, they didn't have a reason for why there was lack of interest. Young people weren't showing up to dealerships anymore. And in 1953, a GM engineer by Zora Duntoff said, well, I know why it is. It's because they can't get parts for Chevrolets to go race them at the drag strip. They have to buy old Fords, and the Fords are easier to upgrade. And he convinced GM to build a performance parts group to bring the V8 to Chevrolet, which up to that point had only been in the higher model Cadillacs. And he was concerned that he was seeing people buy old Chevrolets and drop Cadillac V8s into them, which was not a very safe thing. And you would see this culture kind of evolve. Let's see, go to the next slide. So this is, once again, it's an old Ford. Very popular amongst the racers, and but it wasn't a new car. So they, automakers track new car sales, not used jolly sales. And you can see there's a V8 in there. You also had, the whole surf culture came up, all about cars. So all of a sudden, cars had gotten this real, performance cars had gotten this real big jolt in the arm. And I don't have the numbers from the 50s to the 70s, but performance of cars from the 1950s to the 1970s, we do have the endpoints. And it went from about, 0 to 60 times in the 24 to 30 second average to, somewhere in the 12 second average. Over that period of time. To give you an idea how much performance was emphasized in car sales, or how much the customer was willing to pay for performance. Also another thing that a lot of people don't realize, but automation was starting to become a little scary to the average person a lot because they didn't understand it, and they didn't know what the future was going to hold. And so this is out of New York Times, I forget, this was early 60s. So you'd start to see articles like this in the early 60s. Now, most of this is about factory automation, but automation in general was getting a bad name, and like agricultural automation, which had been one of the leading areas of automation, almost all the research dried up because of the fear of the backlash. And it was such a big deal that that by 1964, President Johnson set up a panel, the Blue Ribbon Commission on Technology, Automation, and the Economy, to study whether or not automation was going to destroy jobs, whether it was going to be a big impact to the economy. And there's a lot of people saying that, you know, America was done if we went to automation. There's a lot of people that said America would be awesome with automation. But in general, it wasn't a good time to be promoting automation for any purposes. You weren't very popular among a lot of constituencies. And so I believe this is, you know, kind of some of the context that influenced some of the thinking. One technology that did get a little bit further into the late 60s and continued to work through the 80s was a driver's aid. This was the experimental route guidance system from 1967. And this was use the infrastructure, wireless communication from the infrastructure to the car to tell the car what route and when to turn. The U.S. Bureau of Public Roads paid to have two intersections done in Washington, D.C. And it says they had approved a pilot of 100 additional intersections for a small scale or medium scale pilot. But you don't hear about that until the 80s with Traftec, which would be a very similar system in the 1980s. So you're starting to see some of the basic ideas. And you do see a lot of research being done in routing in the early 60s. A lot of the fundamental algorithms that computer scientists use, like Dijkstra's algorithm, were developed in the early 60s. Ohio State continued working on automation through the 70s. Robert Fenton, you know, really was a big advocate for the entire time. He never lost faith in the technology, and this is one of the Ohio State vehicles. And of course, we get to the 80s, and well, it's, you know, we do have some of these guided vehicles on without rails, but this is the General Motors concept. For this was called linear motors, but. Then we get to the 90s.
Consortium applies AVG systems to individual passenger transport. The demonstration shows platooning, cars traveling at the same speed and at short distances from each other. The cars are able to change lane and join or detach from a platoon automatically.
So Steve, this is your guys.
Under the road surface, the cars are able to stay in their lane. The greatest advantage of platooning is that a much greater degree of utilization of the infrastructure can be achieved.
Approaching destination.
The European SAFE project makes a contribution towards increasing road safety. A complete detection system has been developed to signal drivers' loss of attention or abnormal driving behavior. In case of driver impairment, the system warns the driver and other road users and then automatically parks the vehicle at the side of the road.
So this would be a safe harbor concept. An interesting time, I'll just kind of show the beginning of this one, next one, and then we'll skip ahead. Oh, one more.
A completely automated form of collective passenger transport is the Park Shuttle, an unmanned people mover that can travel on normal roads. The vehicle finds its way using transponders underneath the road surface. The passenger chooses from a number of destinations, and the Park Shuttle then automatically travels along the designated route. The European Chauffeur project works on an electronic link between two trucks. Only the first truck has a driver. It is intended that the trucks will be able to travel at speeds of some 85 kilometers per hour and at a very short distance from each other. A variety of sensors are used to ensure that the second vehicle can be navigated in perfect safety.
And then this one, let's see, time-wise, oops. And I bumped past the 80s, but there was really a lot of work being done in Europe in the 80s. There was the entire Prometheus program, which I think was close to $1 billion. There was the Dickmans in Germany was doing a tremendous amount of work in automation without infrastructure. But by the time we get to the 90s, we're starting to talk a little bit more about vehicle-centric technologies, not infrastructure
cruise control that you can set and maintain your position in traffic. Now that would be real driving convenience. That may soon become a reality with advanced technology developed at the General Motors Technical Center. Operating the system is just slightly different from today's cruise control. Once the cruising speed is set, you select a comfortable distance for the system to maintain between vehicles. As you approach a slower moving vehicle, your car automatically adjusts its speed to maintain the preset distance, allowing you to pass if you wish and resume your previous speed. If a cutoff occurs or the closure rate is too fast, an alert sounds so that you can take appropriate action. Adaptive Cruise. GM is setting the pace for safer highway driving. These vehicles are steering themselves with the help of two advanced
systems. Like I said, there's a lot of work going on in this area. I had access to these videos because I worked with GM.
Lane lock and lane track.
And this is kind of what I grew up with, but there was not to put down any other work that was going on. This is just the work that I'm most familiar with. I got to hear about this at lunch all the time.
And locks into the lane. An alert will sound if the vehicle wanders out of its lane and can warn the driver about obstacles that lie ahead. This lane sensing system.
Anyway, I was going to skip ahead. We also had programs like the NavLab program at Carnegie Mellon, the No Hands Across America, where they had an automated vehicle drive the vast majority, I forget, it's the high 90s percent of the time, using just onboard sensors. You had the path platooning program in the 90s, which was actually largely the government saying, hey, we want to do the stuff we talked about back in the 50s. We want to do it now. And this used the baryomagnet technology, brought on board radar technology. And I believe, Steve, was it the head car-to-car communication? Okay, so car-to-car communication, which is a common theme. We're seeing a lot of it, but here it's actually working. And Steve could probably answer better what happened on the out years, but interest kind of died away for a little bit. And there's certainly stuff going on. What you are seeing is some production launches. This is the first car to get adaptive cruise control. And that wasn't a very good adaptive cruise control, but it was a very early LiDAR system. But then you'd see Jag and Mercedes a few years later, and eventually Cadillac and a number of different other automakers. But you're starting to see some of these sensors actually make it to production. So this is actually starting to look a little more hopeful than seeing this pattern over and over again of getting excited about the technology and then and dropping back. Nissan, our lovely host here, brought out the first lane keeping system in the world on the 2001 SEMA. And these technologies got a foothold, and they were able to stay around long enough to keep going. There are a lot of other technologies in automotive history that get out there, and we're not ready for them. Case in point, back in the 60s, Ford had suggested as an alternative to the GM vehicle-to-car and vehicle-to-vehicle communication system their own Ford safety radio, which was effectively CB. And CB did become a production technology based on that research, but then it went away. Was it? The technology wasn't good, wasn't useful, the customer didn't care for it. I don't know because I never studied CB radio sales, but other technologies came and went. But this technology is looking like it's got some staying power. I've got both adaptive cruise control and lane keeping in my personal car, and I love them. I think they're awesome. And then we get to the DARPA challenge. So even though this is the event that really made automated driving really popular, and I would argue that the fact that it was a race, one of the first really publicized race of automated vehicles is what drew people's attention. And I think that having competitive type events like this both drive technology and also drive interest. If you think about how many people watch racing events, people talk about, oh, soccer is so big, or what's the other one? Cricket. If you look at the Monaco, 650 million viewers for the Monaco F1 races. So it's a
pretty amazing how popular racing is when people who are doing the driving aren't the people who are watching it. But anyway, that's kind of my main part of my talk, and I think I'm a little over what Allison had asked for. And I went to more slides, but I was kind of want to do more of an interactive discussion and kind of get your thoughts. And I kind of threw some of this together at the last minute, so I haven't completely fleshed it all out. But I guess that's kind of the main thrust. Steve, did I mess anything up?
Oh.
Yeah, very, very good talk. Very interesting. Lots of good videos that I wish I had watched all through before in my life. The intellectual property, patent, etc. What was the hurdle that the different companies faced when all of them were trying to do similar to other and so on over time with multiple car companies that existed and that still exist now? What were the issues?
So I haven't had a chance to do the patent research myself. And sometimes in the technology, I'll do that. I did not see it ever come up, patents being brought up in any of the either news literature or the research papers. Some of the work along the years was federally funded, and so the IP issues wouldn't have been as big an issue when it was federal dollars being put in. But I think there was also the thought that that once the technology had gotten out there, that everyone would have to have it, so it couldn't be a monopolizing type of a patent. And already at the standpoint as it was, GM was already worried about monopoly issues in the 1950s and 60s about being broken up. And so
was an agreement between the companies not to...
I don't know that there was an agreement, but I would imagine that it appears that there was no conflict.
I see that in USA, right?
Yeah.
So you want people to compete and so on, and at least the guided wire concept, once it is done, everyone else is using it.
Yeah.
And what are the deals? did they have different techniques to do the same automatic steering, automatic cruise control? Was they all different? I'm still looking at and I'm trying to understand what went through. It cannot be a national consensus in a country like USA. China probably yes, right? Here it wouldn't happen.
So there was a lot of optimism in the 1950s that it could happen. If you read the material at the time and you're trying to look at it step by step, in fact, there was big discussions involving, I think it was insurance companies and state highway organizations about, there was one very colorful gentleman who said, if this technology is not on the road in 5 years, it's because it's a conspiracy to keep it off the road. And there's a big argument between whether we should have full automation first and just skip any type of driver assist, or whether driver assist really would help. But I think there was pretty much agreement that the technology should go forward. And there didn't seem, at least from the research that I read, to be any patent posturing at that time. And I don't think that was necessarily the character of how automotive research was done at the time, but it's what was interesting is how open automakers were with what would now be considered closed ideas. Like I'll put this up here. General Motors did their entire reliability analysis on their system and published it. where's my cursor?
Publishing is okay after the AP, right?
Well, no, for reliability today, you would never publish your reliability data as an automaker. But this isn't the numbers, but they did the numbers. But this was basically what would be a fault tree today that General Motors published before fault trees had even been invented. And so they went through and explained all of the redundancies and how they would work and what the probabilities were. And this type of thing would normally be considered a trade secret today. But at the time, it seemed to be much more open with sharing. And I can't tell you about the IP stuff because I'm not an IP person and I didn't study the patents of the time, but you didn't see it show up in any of the literature or the papers.
Yeah, actually
You just answered my second question. It was there much engineering in anticipation of failures? But my first question was, in the timeline when you're looking at things, did you see a bump around the early 60s when the Unsafe at Any Speed, Nader's book, came out?
So the early 60s, you did see a lot more press on automated driving and a lot more focus on, we have to do this because, you know, safety is really important. So I think that would, I hadn't thought of it, but that would certainly play into that. So the press certainly spiked in the early to mid-60s, even as the automakers were starting to pull back. And that may have been part of the decision to pull back, now that I think about it. I was trying to figure out what's all going on in that era, but certainly the reliability had been something that General Motors had spent a lot of time looking at. Their engineers had done a lot of control systems in World War II and would do the guidance system on the Apollo, which, you know, really set the groundwork for reliability engineering. And a lot of the tools that we have now from reliability engineering and safety analysis come from this era. Also, the fly-by-wire system used on the Apollo, you can trace its heritage to some of the work that was done on the GM Firebirds. Aviation fly-by-wire really wouldn't take off as a research field until the mid-60s, and GM was starting this work in the mid-50s. And like I said, I don't know the impact, but I think that's one of the things we've got to consider when we try to assess why did the interest drop off. And certain Ralph Nader's book both seem to have a positive spike on the press, but maybe a negative spike on the automakers in terms of their interest in working in this field, possibly. Ralph? Go.
So in the midst of this period, the 1950s and 1960s, where you see all this press coming out and a tremendous amount of car culture, if you will, mm-hmm. What was the consumer reaction to all of this? Because, you know, we've seen what the manufacturers are pushing out. What were the consumers thinking?
Good question. So there isn't a whole lot of consumer-facing literature, other than a few surveys, which were kind of mixed to negative. Just I mentioned as earlier is the trust and the lack of control. And what's kind of unfortunate, but tells us that we have a job cut out for us, is research done, you know, by University of Michigan Transportation Research Institute over the last few years have found that the issues with giving up control and the issues of trust are very similar in nature. With, you know, I have to look up the data, but only 4% of people today that they studied would be willing to go into an automated vehicle with no manual override controls. And I think it was about a third who were interested in full autonomy without ever having to drive the car, but as long as there was controls, and then, you know, it goes from there. But I can get the report. I think one of the biggest issues is overcoming the customer interest in the technology, and I don't think that is currently being solved right now. And I've got some other stuff if people are interested in why I think that the car culture hasn't changed. In fact, has started to actually pick up quite a bit. Oh.
So,
Chris,
did you
want to?
Sure. Hi. We've got, I work with the Electric Vehicle Entrepreneurs of Silicon Valley, mm-hmm. and we've got a meeting coming up this Thursday, 12 noon. This is in Sunnyvale on Lawrence Expressway in Central. It's going to be at Sneha Indian Buffet, so if you like Indian food, you can eat all you want. It's a free event. You just pay for the meal. Also want to announce the EV Rally this Saturday. That's going to be at De Anza College. So you can either look at our website, which is evesv.com, and you can check out both events there. EAA is the real sponsor of the Saturday EV Rally. Thanks, Ellison.
I guess we had some...
I just have a comment about what I read in the news in the mm-hmm. New York Times. I don't know if you heard of this, but the automakers are planning to have automatic avoidance collision mm-hmm. to prevent rear ends. Have mm-hmm. you read about that?
Yeah. So I've actually got it on my car, and I've worked on the feature in the past. So
When over the years, when these active safety features have been released on low volume cars, the NHTSA tends to study the effectiveness, and some turn out to be really effective, and some actually make things worse. And one of the ones that turned out to be really effective was automatic emergency braking. It's much more effective than the collision warning systems in terms of reduction. And so you started to see a trend, first in Europe, where they were making automatic emergency braking mandatory on trucks, and then you started to see automakers roll on across their vehicles. Each system works a little bit differently, so it'll be interesting to see where, if there is federal guidelines, where they end up, as to like what speeds they have to work at and what G-forces they're allowed to brake. That's a technology that it's not necessarily being driven by customer demand, but it's being driven by the fact that it's really effective.
And usually the government will come and mandate it.
The government will mandate it. Over, if there is enough data over years, and it usually takes about a decade of actual deployed systems. The first collision mitigation, fully automated braking systems came out around 2006, 2007. I think Volvo City Safety was launched about that time frame. And so there's almost a decade of data to see whether the technology actually works in the real world. ABS, as it turns out, was mixed. ABS would increase accidents under a lot of conditions, and they decided not to mandate ABS. Even then, they're very cautious about mandating technology unless they think that there really is benefit and there's not going to be a big backlash against it.
So Google just got a new leader for the program. Mm-hmm. Is there a projection in terms of when this might be reality in larger scale? Is the self-driving car on the road?
So I can't speak for Google, but I think it really depends on a matter of degree. So you are seeing traffic jam assist and type features are being launched right now. You can either, I think there are cars right now, you can get them, and high levels of automation or mid levels of automation you'll see fairly soon. Part of the question I wanted to pose with my presentation, I don't think I quite got there yet, was whether we're going to get to full automation or we're going to get to crash free but still allowing the human to drive, which I think is a much more is a choice that at least gives the customer choice. And I think that's a big thing that we saw with, I didn't get to a whole bunch of it, but customers like personalization of the car, they like customization of the car. It was a big part of the 1950s custom car hot rod movement. It's also a huge part of today's custom car movement. And so people like to drive, and in today's generation is much more so than previous generations, despite what the news may have said, and I've got some data on that. But having cars that have the ability to be both manually driven and automatically driven, I think is in my opinion, my personal opinion, a very prudent technical approach. When that happens depends and to what level. I think it's going to continue on a continuum, but I think to get to those higher levels of automation, like the SAE level 3 and 4, it's really kind of hard to say because there's a lot of the unknowns in terms of largely, I think, to do with the reliability of complex systems and verification and validation of these systems haven't been developed yet. And the current models for how complex systems are validated don't necessarily apply to automotive systems. So I think there's a lot of invention that needs to happen, not in the hardware, but in the how do we know that these systems are reliable. So
both in the late 1950s and early 1950s and now we have the development of new technologies that seem to make self-driving cars almost a reality, mm-hmm. at least technically feasible.
Yeah.
You have the press jumping on this and saying this is going to happen quickly and it's going to be amazing. Is there any similarities or big differences in the way the press has been covering this now versus how it was covered in the heyday of the self-driving car movement?
So at least from the limited sampling I did, it seemed actually very, very similar. Unfortunately, I didn't have access to a lot of magazines from the 1950s other than the New York Times and a handful of ones that were at PATH, so I wasn't able to tell how broad the discussion was, but certainly, Popular Science, Popular Mechanics covered it, the New York Times covered it, even though I mentioned Pageant covered it. Because I don't think that this coverage is a big
differentiator. In fact, I think that's one of the similarities I was trying to call attention to. Also, you are starting to get some of this automation anxiety start to show up, and I don't know if that's going to continue or if it's just kind of a passing thing. But there are some similarities in that regard. And then also, like I mentioned, the custom car culture is I've got some, I can show you some interesting slides, but it's really starting to take off. And just one case in point, it's not really data, but you know, the third grossing movie of all time was Furious 7, which is custom cars. And the car customization business is now larger than it's ever been, at $36 billion. Just put some statistics up.
So is anybody from Pageant Magazine here this evening?
Oh. just an interesting one, and there's some interesting articles along with this. But back around 2012, people were worried that millennials weren't interested in cars. And, well, we've seen a pretty big change since then in terms of millennial car purchase rates, largely due to, I think, the economics have changed in the time period. And also, I think the nature of the cars that they're buying, a lot of the cars weren't available. Mid-size pickup trucks, which are very popular among millennials, weren't really available in the early 2010s, as are a lot of the performance cars. There's a lot more performance cars available that seem to be really popular. So I wouldn't count on dropping interest in cars being the reason we can just assume that everyone's going to accept automation. I think we actually have to work at evangelizing the technology, that we have to go out and not just be the engineers, but also be the people who are getting people excited. So,
very good. Everybody has their mission statement now. Mm-hmm. So with that, I'd like to wrap up the formal portion of this evening's meeting. We'd like to thank Dan very much for an entertaining and thought-provoking presentation. On behalf of Nissan, I present you with this polo shirt.
Well, thank you.
Which hopefully is the right size. And thanks, everyone, for coming. We invite you to continue the informal discussion. We invite you to the Transportation of the Future event on October 14th and our October 19th talk about ECU engineering and the CAN and LIN buses inside the car. And with that, we'll call the formal proceedings to an end. Good night.
I was trying to get the thought provoking, you know, in terms of